Pirates and Pepper, from the 1960 edition of the Leatherneck magazine, written by Bernard Nolte, read by Nick Wilson. A whale oil lamp flickered wildly as a tall, sun-bronzed man, his face furrowed, his eyes faded from too many hours of staring out over the empty sea, grimly signed his name to a letter on the desk before him. He was Charles Endicott, skipper of the merchantman Friendship. His letter told of a profitable cruise in the Dutch East Indies, of piracy and of murder. While Friendship was loading a cargo of pepper at the port of Kuala Batu, Sumatra, a band of natives had rowed alongside, clambered aboard, and seized the ship. Endicott's first mate and two of his seamen had been hacked to pieces when they tried to resist and stop the pirates. Aided by sailors from other merchantmen in the harbor, the crew of Friendship had driven off the pirates, but before they fled, the natives destroyed a cargo valued at $12,000 in gold. The letter over which the captain had sweated found its way through diplomatic and military channels to the desk of the Secretary of the Navy. In an attack upon a vessel flying the Stars and Stripes, three Americans had been murdered. What Endicott asked, did the Navy intend to do about it? Within a month, the secretary answered, USS Potomac, 44 guns, was on its way to Sumatra. On February 5, 1832, the vessel arrived off Kuala Batu. All her gun ports were closed and painted over, and her distinct rigging had been changed. From the distance, she resembled an unarmed Yankee merchantman on a peaceful trading cruise. Commodore John Downs, her captain, hoped that pirates would attack, but they did not rise to the bait. A pair of natives finally paddled out to Potomac, but these were not pirates. Instead of plunder, they were interested in selling fresh fish to the crew. Not until they were within a dozen yards of the vessel did they realize she was a man of war. Before the natives could recover from their surprise, Downs had them seized and hurled into the brig. Except for this attempt at ship-to-ship salesmanship, the villagers did not venture near the American ship. By dawn of February 6th, Downs had decided that the pirates weren't going to attack. He would have to make the first move. Dressed as a merchant seaman, Navy Lieutenant Irvin Shubrick, Marine Lieutenant Alvin Edson, and five other ship's officers swaggered ashore to spy out the lay of the land. They returned at sunset. They brought news that deepened the furrows across Downs' forehead. The, quote, merchant sailors, muttering in Pigden English and gesturing frantically, had tried to arrange an interview with Soltanpoh Mahomet, the Rajah of Kuala Batu. Their offer to trade gold for pepper got them nowhere. Each time they so much as looked at Mahomet's hut, a fierce-looking guard would whip out his knife and, with a few unmistakable gestures, let the Americans know what would happen if they didn't leave. Worse still, the scouting party reported that 500 armed Malays manned three wooden blockhouses guarding the approaches to Kuala Batu. Around 2 a.m. February 7th, Commodore Downs ordered away the landing party. He had divided his crew into three assault sections, each to storm one of the forts. Two of these sections were made up of blue jackets, while Lieutenant Edson's Marines made up the third. To gain tactical surprise, the Marines were to hit the stockade at the rear of the village at the same moment the sailors began their attacks on the two forts nearest the beach. A few minutes before sunrise, Edson heard the sound of firing in the distance and immediately waved his men forward. Moving on the double, the Marines crossed an open field. Only a few yards to go, and still there was no sound from the fort. Two ship's carpenters sprinted forward and with heavy crowbars pried the wooden gates from their hinges. A short struggle with a knife and a bayonet, and the fight was ended. On the other side of the village, one division of sailors had won its objective. The second had stirred up the hornet's nest. Time and time again, these blue jackets had charged, only to be beaten back by desperate Malays. Muskets proved useless. It was a battle of cutlass against the sharp, thin Chris. But the cutlass finally won out. After 2 hours of vicious fighting, the fort was taken, but only because the Marines and other naval detachment had joined the fray. Next, the landing party began the destruction of Kuala Batu. Flimsy shacks exploded into towering pillars of flame as they put the torch to the deserted village. Sweating, smeared with powder and smoke, the sailors and Marines were looking forward to the double ration of grog and plenty of sack time when the fourth fort suddenly opened up on them. Cunningly camouflaged in the dense jungle, it had been overlooked by the Americans. From within the stockade, the natives chanted their war songs and blazed away with cannon and musket. Grimly, the sailors and Marines swept forward, only to be thrown back. They formed and charged again. This time, the blue-clad wave engulfed the walls, but the Americans could not keep their precarious hold on the gates. Every available man joined in the final assault, slowly gaining momentum. The attackers rolled onwards, crashed through the gates, and spilled into the fort. Bayonets made quick work of the handful of defenders who did not flee into the forest. At the cost of 2 killed and 11 wounded, the pirate strongholds had been captured. Although the village had been destroyed and the 4 forts leveled, Commodore Downes was not convinced that they had broken the fierce spirit of the Malays. At about midnight, under a full moon, Potomac glided across the silvery water and anchored a few hundred yards from the ruins of the pirate den. The mighty ship trembled slightly as she unleashed her first broadside. Again and again, flames blossomed from the half-light, and choking clouds of powder and smoke drifted lazily towards the shore. After an hour's bombardment, a lookout sighted a white flag waving near the edge of the jungle. Downes immediately ceased firing. Early the following morning, a small party went ashore under a flag of truce. Although they found the place deserted, they did discover several white flags flying from the shattered forts. Later in the day, a native messenger rode out to Potomac with the Rajah's solemn promise to respect the stars and stripes in the future. Glancing nervously at the mighty cannon, he begged Downes not to resume his bombardment. Satisfied that he had pacified the pirates, he set sail to join the Pacific Squadron. No sooner had Potomac disappeared over the horizon than the work of reconstruction began. First, the fortifications were repaired. Then, a new village was built. Within a month or two, the pirates of Kuala Batu were doing business as the same old stand. At first, they were reluctant to attack the American vessels, for the roar of a cannon still rang in their ears. But gradually, they grew bolder until the Navy Department was forced to organize another expedition to crush them. On December 21, 1838, two American vessels, the frigate Columbia and the sloop John Adams, arrived off the coast of Sumatra. On Christmas Eve, Captain George C. Reed of Columbia demanded an apology from the pirate chieftains. His message was ignored, and the following day bombardment began. Adams was first to open fire, raking a flotilla of native boats with grape shot. She then shifted her fire to the forts, smothering them in a torrent of round shot. Later, Columbia joined the barrage, but no troops landed, and early in the afternoon, both vessels withdrew. Over the next few days, the tribesmen debated among themselves. Many of them could recall the burning of Kuala Batu by Commodore Downes' expedition, and on the morning of the 28th, a small boat bearing a white flag slipped across the sea towards the American flagship. As the tiny vessel drew alongside, Columbia's Marines, expecting some sort of trick, stood by with loaded muskets. A handful of thoroughly frightened chiefs clambered over the rail to stammer their apologies for having offended the powerful United States. With the natives of Kuala Batu cowed in submission, Captain Reed was free to deal with newer pirate redoubt in the town of Muki. The men of Muki, who never faced the Marines' bayonets nor felt the earth tremble from the sound of American guns, were obstinate. Haughtily, they scorned the Navy officer sent to talk with them. When Reed sent a message stating that he would bombard the city in exactly 24 hours, the warriors laughed. On the morning of January 2, 1839, the warship ran out their guns, moved closer to the beach, and opened fire. At 9:30 a.m., the first charge of grapeshot ripped through the thatched huts of Muki. Rounds of solid shot splintered into the thick wooden palisade of the main fort. In vain, the natives tried to return fire, for their largest guns could not reach the American ships. Bravely, they stood by their weapons, but courage alone could not stop the deadly rain. One of the men was hurled backwards from the wall, torn to pieces in vicious grape. One by one, they dropped their muskets and broke for cover. Nothing could withstand the American guns. For more than 2 hours, the gunners fired as fast as they could reload. Then the barrage slackened, and a landing party was sent out from Adams. Without encountering any opposition, the men from the sloop occupied the deserted village and began burning the crudely built houses. In the afternoon, they were joined by a detachment from Columbia. These men razed the fortifications, burning stores of powder and pulling down the walls. Two natives were found hiding in the village. Both surrendered without a struggle. On the morning of January 4th, the ships moved slowly out to sea. The power of the pirates of Sumatra had been crushed at last. two expeditions had been needed to convert the Malays from pirates to peaceful traders. Victors in battles for right and freedom, the Marines had done their share winning the war over the pepper trade. Author's bio. Bernard Nolte was a well-known author who frequently wrote on historical military subjects. Believing that the history of African Americans in the military was inadequately researched, he wrote Strength for the Fight, A History of Black Americans in the Military, and edited a 13-volume Blacks in the United States Armed Forces with Morris J. McGregor, Jr.